He's Fred Hershkowitz, c'est moi, host of Home Fries, 8 p.m. Friday nights. Live radio, comedy, call-ins, and music on WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM.
I can't understand the feeling I get when you roll your pretty eyes that way.
On Sunday, March 20th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Apollo Theater, NOBO, the Network of Black Organizers, will present a poetry jam session honoring International Working Women's Month. The All-Women Sister Fire Poetry Jam will be hosted by Sister Hazel Beckles and feature Amina Baraka, Rosemary Mealy, Camille Yarborough, Wajinku Reynolds, Asha Bandele, Yvette Davila, Shirley Hawkins, and other women poets with diverse styles. Sister Jaribu Hill of Serious Business will sing, and Sister Ifachu Okeke will play jazz. For further information, call 212-595-9523. That's 212-595-9523. That's Sunday, March 20th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Apollo Theater.
It's that time again, and once more, WBAI is giving the Radio Free Aaron crew all day to talk about, promote, inform, support, blaspheme, honor, praise, criticize, evangelize, demonize, apologize, and satirize. All things Irish. Sure, a lot's happened lately. Gerry Adams has come and gone, and that gave a lot of us something good to feel about, a sense of accomplishment, but we still have a long way to go. So join us on St. Patrick's Day, Thursday, March 17th, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., for a full day of politics, music, comedy, and crack, only on 99.5 WBAI, New York.
And it's a couple of minutes after 10 o'clock. We're sorry for the technical problems that we were having, but they're solved now for the most part. It's time for Off the Hook. Oh, maybe they're not solved. Yes. Off the Hook on WBAI. And this is Off the Hook with Emmanuel Goldstein here until 11 o'clock. This is one of these days where just everything technical that can go wrong goes wrong. Certain knobs don't do what they're supposed to do, and you don't hear things you're supposed to be hearing. And that's kind of what Off the Hook is all about things that don't quite go right with technology. Happens every day, happens all the time, happens to every single one of us, and sometimes we don't even know it. Oh, it's a lot of fun. We have special guest tonight. We have some updated news on various topics, and of course we'll be taking your phone calls at about 10:30 or so, and updating you on all kinds of other things as well. Has anybody followed the story that took place over the past couple of weeks? I'm not sure if we even mentioned it here on this particular radio program, the whole Tanya Harding affair. I guess that's probably why we didn't mention it, because I'm averse to that kind of thing myself. I don't really like to talk about the mainstream, primetime TV movie-type news. But in this particular case, I think it's kind of pertinent to what we discuss here, because it involved something having to do with reporters. It involves something having to do with electronic mail. And, of course, by that token, it has something to do with hackers. Seems that a bunch of reporters snooped into Tanya Harding's electronic mail. Now, what do you think about that? Isn't that something that, you know, you read about hackers disrupting everybody's lives and making things miserable and sticking potholes in the information superhighway and all that kind of thing. And then these same reporters, or at least reporters that are, you know, friends of those reporters or what have you, go and do the same thing. Or actually, they don't do the same thing. They do something completely different. They go and they target somebody and they read their mail and they do it for some particular purpose, not just curiosity. They do it to get a good story. Who knows why they do it? They do it to show off to each other. I don't know, but all I know is if hackers had done that, it would have been a completely different story. It would have been on the front page. They would have been calling for blood. People would have been sent to prison. Can anyone of us doubt that? I mean, that seems pretty clear to me. In this particular case, though, hey, it was just a bunch of reporters. They didn't look at anything. They were very clear to say that. They just logged in and then quickly logged out again. Yeah. Well, this story comes from the Risk Digest. And this is reposted from the Metro Times, which is a freely distributed alternative newspaper in Detroit. And Dennis Rosenblum reports on yet another ethically questionable activity ironically associated with the violation of Tanya Harding's email at the Olympics. Both the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press reported that Free Press sports reporter Michelle Kaufman, with two other reporters from other papers, broke into Harding's account but did not read any mail. The Free Press story was printed on page 8D in the sports section. Isn't that fascinating? In New York, it would be called page D8, but in Detroit, it's called page 8D. I just love cultural differences in America. So fascinating. But the news printed its story on page 1A, there you go again, the front page, and portrayed it as much more scandalous, this whole incident of breaking into Tanya Harding's email. Well, the news and Free Press operate under a joint operating agreement. It's a controversial arrangement which allowed the two supposedly editorially different papers to combine their business and production facilities to cut costs. And with a 100-year federal antitrust exemption. Both papers argued successfully in federal court that the Free Press would go out of business if not for this agreement. Imagine if, let's say, the Post and the Daily News. No, better yet, imagine if the New York Times and the Post had some sort of an agreement where they shared advertising and business sections or facilities, but had supposedly independent editorial policies. Well, I don't know. Anyway, the twist comes in when the Detroit News ran a photo of Kaufman with their front page story. The digital image was stolen from the production facilities in the news building, which both papers share. According to Rosenblum, it turns out that a photo of Kaufman, which this is the sports reporter for the Detroit Free Press, turns out that a photo of Kaufman, which the news ran with its story, came from Free Press computer files. A news editor had a composting room worker sneak along a copy of the digital photo file without the knowledge of the Free Press. And since they share these offices, it's not that hard to do. Not that hard at all. Ed Wendover, a leader of Citizens for an Independent Press, which opposed the JOA in court, JOA being that agreement that allows the two papers to do that, considered it predictable. This is perhaps only a precursor of what happens when they move in together, said Wendover, who is a suburban publisher. In a memo to editors at the News, editor and publisher Robert Giles termed it a clear breach of the security that is critical to maintaining editorial separation and independence as required by the joint operating agreement. Now, the irony of this story is obvious, but according to this contributor, the risk involves the impact of lax computer security on the First Amendment issues concerning the distinct editorial voices that were promised under that particular joint operating agreement. It also goes to show that a lot of reporters don't really care how low they stoop, even if it's involving fellow reporters. There's all kinds of possibilities inherent therein. And here's another story. This one comes from also the Risks Digest. This is a piece from Stephanie Leaf. Aha. No, that's really her last name, Aha, A-H-A. I've never quite said anything like that, but it's true. I kind of feel sorry for her, but never mind that. I just received my new credit card in the mail, only it wasn't mine. The paper enfolding the card had my name and account number, but the card had a different name and account number. The credit card company claimed that this had never happened before, blocked both accounts as having lost/stolen cards, and is sending me a new card. I was really surprised to be the first one having this problem. I would assume that this could happen if the entire run of cards mailed was off by one and we all received the right paper with the wrong cards. Compounding the problem, they have redesigned the card this year so that the names are printed in the same color as the card, making them hard to read. Only by chance did I look closely enough to notice that it wasn't my card. Perhaps the entire line did go astray after all. Unfortunately, this person did not mention what kind of card it was. Otherwise, we could have people check their wallets right now and see if they have other people's cards in them. Yeah, it could happen. I mean, how often do you check your card to see if it's yours when you get one in the mail? Yeah, it says it on the piece of paper, but you actually check the card? Did you actually check your magnetic stripe? Huh? Maybe the magnetic stripe has somebody else's name on it. It could happen anywhere. Oh, boy. I hope you're all ready for the 90s, because all kinds of fun things are going to happen like that. And finally, this is from the Associated Press, a harbinger of things to come. Not the Associated Press, but this story. A woman in Pembroke, Massachusetts, used the caller ID feature to track down an obscene caller who had been bothering her since 1991. Well, hats off to you. You figured out how to look at a display and read a number. Great! Wonderful! I'm sure the phone company's going to get all the mileage out of this that they possibly can. This is 9X, of course, in Massachusetts. After years of harassment, the woman signed up with her phone company for the caller ID service, compiled a map with the numbers and addresses of public phone booths in her vicinity, and obtained a second telephone line to alert police. Her efforts paid off last Saturday at about 2:30 a.m., leading to the arrest of a 28-year-old suspect who was still on the phone when the police arrived. Well, this is wonderful, except what this woman has done is successfully done the work of the phone company. She's gotten her second telephone line, she's paid for caller ID, she's compiled a map of all the names and addresses of pay phones, and she stayed up until 2:30 in the morning dealing with all this garbage, when the phone company can simply say, well, you know, this person called you at this particular time, period, this is it, this is our technology, we have the capability of doing this. But no, the mentality these days is to have somebody be charged all this extra money and go through all this extra effort, when the phone company can just do it with a flick of a switch. Not even that. The data is there. All they have to do is call it up and find it and wait for it to happen again. It's very simple. Now, if this can be used against people as far as surveillance and phone taps and pen registers and things like that, well, then why can't it be used to help people instead of making them pay for such ridiculous services as Call Trace, where you pay $1.50 to dial *57, which will send the number of the person that just called you someplace, and if you do it about 10 times, maybe they'll take notice, and if you call them, maybe they'll actually tell the person that you're being annoyed by them. They won't tell you who those people are that are annoying you, but they'll find out who you are. It's a crazy system. I don't quite understand it, but that's the way it is. Okay, that's pretty much all the news updates that we have right now. When we come back, we'll have a special guest, and we'll have an update on fiber optic as well. And we'll be taking your listener phone calls here on Off the Hook. Well, this week the news from prison where Fiber Optic is being held over there in Minersville, Pennsylvania. News is fairly good. Last week we told you how he was shoveling snow 8 hours a day and against doctor's orders, actually. Well, you'll be pleased to know that he's been switched to dishwashing, so now he's inspiring himself by washing dishes every other day for about 8 hours, or maybe even more. I'm not sure about that. I'll be seeing him again this weekend coming up, and passing along all the good wishes of the people that have been writing in and sending things. He does appreciate the mail he's been getting, and please keep that coming. We have on the phone with us a very special guest, somebody who has been through the mill, so to say. You see, Fiber Optic is somebody that has been sent to prison for crimes of computer hacking, for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, for boasting about knowledge, for spreading information, for telling people how things work, and for being on this program and sharing his knowledge there. But something that's very important to point out, Fiber Optic is not the only one. There are quite a few other people that have met similar fates, quite a few other people that are out there getting information, helping people out, learning about various things, and looked upon as a threat by people and governments and corporations and other entities that just don't understand and see anybody that winds up in a place that they don't have a written note saying that they're allowed to be there. They see anybody like that as a big threat, as somebody that's going to cause all kinds of problems. Well, tonight's big threat is a hacker known as Acid Freak. We know him as Eli here. And Eli just got out of prison a couple of days ago, and we want to welcome you back home.
Thank you very much.
He isn't quite out of it yet. I believe, Eli, you're supposed to stay in your house now for about 6 months. Is that right?
Well, actually, I'm waiting for a phone call from the probation department to tell me when they'll be by to put this bracelet gadget on me.
So you're going to have one of those?
Then I'll have to stay here for 6 months.
One of those electronic bracelets that... Well, I know our listeners are curious how it works. Do you have any idea how that kind of thing works?
How it works? Well, they put these sensors by my door, and if I pass those sensors while wearing the bracelet, it'll signal a contraption by my phone to call them at the central office, and then they'll have my probation officer notified, which will then call my house to see if I'm here or drop by or whatever she likes.
Uh-huh. Wow. So, can you tell us something about the case? You were part of the, I guess, the MOD arrest and conviction.
Yeah, that is correct.
Now, what exactly happened? When did it happen? What were you sentenced for? And where did they send you?
Wow.
In no particular order.
Well, basically, I was sentenced for crimes that I allegedly committed in 1989. Actually, it was over a period of 2 or 3 months in 1989. And, well, basically they didn't indict me in the Eastern District when I had first been indicted, and they had just dropped the case there. And then 2 years later, the Southern District picked it up because I had been known to associate with two or three others, one of which was Mark Fiber Optic, and they decided to reindict me on that.
Is that something that happens often when people are reindicted for the same thing?
Well, one thing you got to understand is it's not all cut and dry when it comes to the government. You know, things like this have, you know, there's a lot of politics involved. You know, it's not just let's go get people who are violating. It's, you know, I want to get that promotion, and you know, we've got to get these laws passed and set precedent here.
It's also a question of publicity too, because you've been fairly prominent in the hacker world and also in the media. You've been on various programs on CBS, NBC. You've been in the Village Voice and many other.
Right, right. Well, yeah, the media played a large part of it, in which I kind of regret, to tell you the truth. You know, when you first start out, you know, the glory gets to you and everything, and you know, you try to make a name for yourself and everything because you're proud of what you're learning and everything. And the media picks up on it and they feed on it, and you don't realize that the government takes that and twists it around and, you know, uses it as evidence, you know?
Uh-huh.
However innocent it may be, you know, I remember I was offered to go on NBC and tell them what happened about a break-in at WNET. And I didn't do it, but once they interviewed me and cut and edited everything and threw me on the air, hey, lo and behold, hey, why'd you do it? You know, suddenly I was answering a question that I wasn't being asked.
Yeah, well, TV has that remarkable ability of doing that. That's why live TV is generally considered a more accurate forum than something that can be edited.
Right, but I mean, it's impossible to deny when you go to court, you know?
Now, do you think that had a lot to do with your conviction?
Yeah, the one thing that really annoyed me was that particular incident because, I mean, to this day, I never crashed any WNET system, and they said I had, and they knew who it was. I mean, they knew who was somebody that was an informant for them or cooperating with them, and they just didn't want to believe it was him. They just kept saying it was me, and, you know, they didn't have any evidence that I did it, but since their, you know, cooperator said that I did it, you know, I must have been responsible.
Well, it's amazing, actually, because virtually everybody in the hacker world knows who was responsible for that. The person I even think has even said that he's responsible for it. The FBI certainly knew who was responsible for it, and I'm sure WNET knew who was responsible for it. Yet, that didn't seem to matter, and this person was never even indicted, and he continued to walk scot-free, and this is somebody that a lot of us don't even consider to be a hacker because he did destructive things. Why do you think they didn't go after this person? Why did they go after people like you instead?
Well, like I said, it's politics. It's easier to get somebody that's right in front of you than to, you know, try and chase somebody else who, you know, who's probably already aware that he's being followed. So they just figured, why don't we hold this guy and, you know, obviously make a case of this. They basically, their idea is, you know, he's pretty much guilty of some things, and we could probably try and prove that in court. So therefore, we could probably infer that he did all these other things because it's so similar to his case, you know.
Now, tell us something about the sentencing when you were actually trying to explain to the judge what was going on.
Well, I stood up and I pled guilty and basically, I don't want to say it was forced, but I was coerced into saying that I did certain things, and the judge dramatically just made a speech saying he couldn't believe why I would crash the WNET system. So I said, Your Honor, I maintain I never did that. And that just baffled him. He just stood there amazed. And I mentioned to him that the government knew who it was and that, you know, they weren't making an attempt to do anything about it. And he was baffled again. And, you know, I might have pissed him off, but, you know, I just had to get that off my chest, you know. So, I mean, he used that as an excuse to sentence me. And when I pointed out that I didn't do it, he wouldn't have it. But at that point, you know, I just totally gave up all hope.
What was it that you had to plead guilty to?
I pled guilty to conspiracy of possession of 15 or more unauthorized access devices, which is basically passwords or calling card numbers and things like that.
And that's it?
Excuse me?
That's it, just conspiracy and having some passwords.
Yeah.
I see. Now, there was... I remember this was being spread around on the net when your sentencing happened, which it was last autumn, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Now, you were trying to explain to the person, to the judge, actually, what it was that how a message could be posted on a bulletin board system, and I don't think he understood quite exactly what you were talking about, and that was, like, pretty
curious. Well, yeah, there was a message left on there, and what happened was I made a little message come out on the printer that said, Happy Thanksgiving, you turkeys, from all of us at MOD. Somebody else, the person who was cooperating with the Secret Service, also happened to be on at the same time. And I was aware of it. And I logged off the system and tried to log back in again. And lo and behold, my message wasn't on the printer. It was on the login, and it said that the whole system was crashed. So when I asked him what had happened, he told me he took my message and edited it and said, ha ha, there's nothing in here. You know, don't bother coming in because everything's erased. And I asked him why, and he was just laughing. You know, I didn't do it, and I tried to explain to the judge how the message could be copied, and he didn't understand. He said, but what is the coincidence? What a coincidence this is. I mean, what are the possibilities that someone would actually do this? I mean, you'd have to get on the computer and, you know, And I just told him, no, you just have to open a word processor and, you know, copy a file over. And he just didn't understand. It was way beyond him.
He thought the only way you could do that would be to retype it all. There's no way to copy a massive amount of data like that.
Well, I don't know what he thought. I thought he was probably thinking that you have to pull wires or something, you know, open up the computer to change a message or something. I don't know what he thinks, but...
Uh-huh. Now, tell us something about your days in prison. You went to what facility?
I was at Allenwood Federal Prison Camp.
In Pennsylvania.
All right.
And how'd they treat you over there?
Well, the camp itself was good, but I was assigned to the welding detail, and the welding detail wasn't on the camp itself. It was for the nearby complex where the penitentiary and the medium security and the high security, the medium, the high, and the low were. And I didn't feel comfortable going in there. You know, the first week I was there, actually the first month I was there, they threw me in the penitentiary to weld steel reinforced walls onto the cells for the maximum security prison, so these inmates wouldn't dig their way to the next cell and kill their next door neighbor or whatever they wanted to do.
I see.
Yeah.
And now you were in there for 6 months, right?
Right.
And I mean, did people treat you any differently because you were a hacker, or you treated with respect? How did the guards treat you? Things like that.
Well, I don't want to say I developed a following, but everybody knew what I was there for. I mean, I was the only guy there for that. And but I basically went in there wanting to be, you know, keep to myself and stay quiet. But I mean, 10 minutes after I was already being like processed in there and admitted, another inmate who I didn't know till later came up to me and said, I don't mean to be nosy, but the guard just told me everything about your case, and it sounds pretty interesting. I just thanked him, and he said, well, I just wanted to let you know.
Wow.
The guards were all talking about it, and, you know, they would come up to me and, you know, mention it and stuff like that. So, I mean, it was no secret, you know.
And did that cause any problems for you?
Well, you know, you have, I had a couple of occasions where shady characters used to come up to me and, you know, kind of hint that, you know, things that I really wasn't interested in. But, you know, you just take that with a grain of salt and keep walking.
So now that you back out, you were released on what day?
I was released on Friday, last Friday, the 11th.
I mean, how does it feel to get out of a situation like that? Is it relief? Is it a shock? What is there?
When you first go in there, I don't know, it must be some kind of a psychological defense mechanism. It just, everything just goes by like a big blur, you know? I still can't believe I was in there. And every day is just so bland. Like, I wasn't really aware of what was going on, you know?
Uh-huh.
Come back here and I feel like I'm actually alive, you know?
Yeah.
I can't explain it, to tell you the truth. I actually thought they were putting something in the food.
You know, it's funny. That's what, when I visited Fiber, he said something like that. He said, tell me if this makes any sense to you, that he has a lot of trouble thinking there, that it's as if he's getting dulled in his senses, and it's very easy to become sort of, I guess, stupid. Did you feel that?
Yeah.
I wonder if there is something in the food, then.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, it's coming back to me now. I'm readjusting. It's like,
yeah.
I feel like I'm awake. It's almost as if I was daydreaming when I was there, you know, the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, which I hope I wasn't, but...
Uh-huh. Well, now... I mean, it's a stupid question, but I think it's one that has to be asked. If you knew that this was going to happen, if you knew that this was, you know, where you would end up, what would you have done differently to avoid it, or would you have done anything differently? I mean, would you have become a hacker at all? Would you just have done something else and suppressed those urges?
Oh, all I can say is, you know, I went through it, and I don't regret it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah. Well, are you still a curious person? Are you still interested in technology? Has that been?
Oh, sure, sure. I've always been. I mean, like I said, these charges stem from 1989. You know, since then I haven't done anything.
Yeah.
Illegal. So, you know, I've always been curious, and I'll always be curious. But I won't be curious in the same way as I was in 1989 and before that.
Uh huh. Now, is there any kind of special restriction that you have now that you're out? Are you not allowed to, say, use a computer or anything like that?
Well, it's interesting that you ask. I met with my probation officer yesterday, and, well, actually, it was a substitute PO because mine wasn't around. And he told me I couldn't get a job in the computer field. He said it was a third-party risk to him, and I just didn't understand it. I mean, I don't know where he's involved in that. I'm working for a company, and he says that he's at risk. Can you explain that to me?
He's at risk?
Yeah, he's at risk.
I see. No, I can't. I don't know how these things
and then,
work.
Well, I mentioned to him that the judge sentenced me to 750 hours of added community service in the computer field, and he wanted to petition that. He wanted it changed, so I still don't know where that's going, but, you know, I don't know. It's like he tried to make things difficult for me, you know?
Uh-huh.
That's the thing that annoys me the most about this whole thing, is that my sentence was more of an annoyance than anything. It didn't teach me anything.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it made me, you know, not want to go in again, you know, and I'll definitely be, you know, be watching my step, you know. I won't do anything illegal anymore. But, you know, it's not like I didn't gain from any of that, you know.
Uh-huh.
Just wasted time.
Do you think any message was sent, like they wanted to send a message?
They've used that sending a message garbage about, I don't know, 10 years ago, you know, when the first hacker got busted.
Yeah.
You know, when Shadowhawk got busted, they said he had to send a message. I mean, that's never going to work, you know? I mean, if it did work, there would be no crimes today because every, you know, first incident would be the message.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's...
What do you think there's a reason? Is it just ignorance on their part that sends people like you to prison or something more sinister?
It's like I said, a lot of politics, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's their job and... You know, I guess in a way, hacking was my job, you know?
Yeah.
It's opposite sides of the coin, and at one point you have to clash. That's what happens.
Well, we're going to be taking some phone calls. I just wanted to ask you one more thing about the media. How you feel media coverage on this particular... Was there media coverage on your particular case?
Yeah, actually, there was a lot of media coverage. On
it. Was it fair in any sense?
I'd have to say it was a little bit unfair,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, the media always has, you know, their ulterior motives, you know. They have to satisfy a wider, you know, wider group of people. I just tell my story. They have to make it better so that everybody will like it. And I don't like that. Everybody's profiting from it, you know. I didn't profit from it,
uh-huh.
You know.
I understand there's going to be a book coming out soon.
Yep, I hear the same thing.
Uh-huh. And do you know anything about that?
All I know is there's a book coming out, and I have hardly anything to do with it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't care to associate with it, you know.
Uh-huh.
Somebody else will pocket the loot and, you know, make a big name for himself about it, but, you know, I don't care to take any part of that.
Well, do you think there's a lot of cases like that of people benefiting off hackers, making money off them?
You know, there's always going to be somebody preying on, you know, the latest fad, you know, whether it be, you know, cyberpunk this or,
you know,
information highway that, you know.
Yeah, because I see a lot of instances of this, and I get phone calls a lot of times from various different reporters. Some are very good, some are very sleazy. And a lot of people are out to make a name for themselves, and they pretty much want a free ride, you know. They want to learn everything there is to know about hacking in the next 10 hours and write a Pulitzer Prize-winning story or something about that. And get all the credit and everything like that and just kind of use people and in some cases incite people to do things that are illegal and very risky to them in order to make their story work.
Yeah.
And I've seen this happen a disturbing number of times. And I know there's a lot of people benefiting off what the hackers are doing. The thing is, these people aren't offering to go to prison for them. You know, they're you know, collecting vast checks for you know, for whatever it is that they are inspired to do from the hackers' exploits. But when it comes to anything bad, well, they're not there for that. And they're not even there to offer you a sympathetic hand, are they?
Only in a very few cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I still have some friends in the media. And
yeah.
They've been good to me, but, I mean, there are others that just won't let up, you know?
Well, do you think hackers should just stop talking to the media altogether?
No, because there are certain times that you want to get it out into the open. I'm just saying, you know, you got to be more careful. You have to be aware of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to realize the consequences. Most of the times, I know when I started, I just thought it was going to be fun and games. I never thought I would get caught, you know?
Right.
But I thought if I was going to get caught, I mean, they wouldn't put a hacker kid in jail.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't realize that. They bust you you know, they raid your house in 1989 and then you get sentenced in 1994, you know, when you've already grown up and you've been through college and, you know, you want to make a living and everything, and that's when it hurts most for uh-huh. you and your family, you know?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you just got to know what you're getting into, you know? It's hard to predict the future, but you've got to, you know?
Well, do you think that the things that you did in 1989 warranted going to prison? You know?
No, absolutely not.
Uh-huh. So it wasn't just a delay, it was actually these things aren't something that deserve to be... for people to be locked up.
It's something that they built up over time, you know?
Right. It's as if they wanted to send you to prison, and they just pretty much collected things until they had enough points to send you to prison.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Do you see this thing changing? Is it getting worse? Have you been following things?
Oh. I mean, I've been following things, and it just seems like, the prosecution will always use the media to their advantage. You know, it makes it seem like a bigger threat. They will use time to their advantage. They raid you one day, and they keep you waiting, and once, you know, the media hype starts to flourish, you know, things get bigger and bigger and juicier for them, and they just wait, you know. It's like waiting until you're ripe, and then mm-hmm. they pounce on you with a good story, you know.
What do you think of this Tonya Harding thing? You follow that at all?
Yeah, I followed it.
It's the reporter incident, I mean, looking at her email.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a bit contradictory, don't you think?
No comments on that.
Yeah. All right, let's take some phone calls then. 212-279-3400. We're talking with Acid Freak, known to us as Eli, who has been in a federal prison for the last 6 months and has just been released. However, he is confined to his home now for the next 6 months with an electronic bracelet. Tell me, when you're allowed to go to work, right?
Yeah, I'm allowed to go to work, go to the hospital on emergencies, and uh-huh. I can go to school,
uh-huh.
and I can go to my house of worship.
And I don't suppose you can go to 2600 meetings.
Unless it's a religion.
Well, that's a thought. we'll look into the odds of doing that. When you go out of your house, just a technical question, when you go out of your house, do you take the bracelet off or do you have to wear it?
You have to wear it.
So you walk around the streets with the bracelet?
Yeah.
Oh, this will be fun.
Yeah, it's really stylish. impresses all your friends.
Does it look like a bracelet or does it beep or something?
I don't know. I mean... I haven't seen it myself. Just supposed to put it on tomorrow, I think.
Well, I'll have to somehow see this, because I've never seen it. It must be people walking around with these bracelets all over the place. We don't know it.
Yeah, well, I have to pay $4.30 for it every day.
You have to pay rent on the bracelet.
Yeah, you know.
That's amazing. Is there an option to buy?
I don't want to buy it.
Okay.
I know that.
Wow. Okay, let's take some phone calls here. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi, you know, it's really too bad that people don't understand technology, and there's one example of this, and I really want to... ...thing to do with what you're saying, but it sort of has to do with what you're saying. I've noticed that in Manhattan, there are a lot of people... that are removing the coin returns out of payphones. I mean, they're just removing the coin returns out of payphones all over Manhattan, and people just throw in a quarter into these payphones with no coin return there, and then when they get their money back for some reason, they just frantically search for it. I mean, wouldn't you know common sense to not use a payphone that looks like that?
Well, by the same token, wouldn't you know not to use a payphone? Doesn't give you a dial tone. I've seen people just
happily
throw money into payphones that have been broken for months.
I want to give out a phone number. If anybody sees a payphone with no coin return or no dial tone, take the time and report it. It's 1-800-NEW-YORK-TEL-COIN. That spells out NYT coin. That's 698-2646. And select option one, report it as a VIP. I always do this because I see all over Manhattan and even Queens and the other boroughs, I don't know why, but the coin return's just removed, and I see some parts of the coin return on top of the payphone too.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, it's profitable for the phone companies for people to use calling cards and not use coins at all. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, I do know that. The other thing is that I've seen a call card that blocks 1-800-ATT, call ATT. It dials every other 800 number except for 1-800 call 800.
Well, that's illegal. They can't do that.
And they don't give you carrier access codes either.
Well, you should report that payphone. You should report that to the Public Service Commission because that is very illegal.
And the 376 exchange, if you dial 212-376-9901, it'll give you a dial tone.
Okay, well, I'm sure you've given our listeners something to think about. Thanks for calling. And let's see if there's another phone call out there. Good evening, you're on.
Oh, hi.
How are you?
To my radio now.
Okay.
Okay, I wanted to mention something about the Clipper chip. You had talked about that a couple of weeks back. There's a electronic petition. I don't know if you've mentioned that on the air at all.
Yeah, we have, but feel free to mention it again.
Okay, yeah, the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, which is a group that opposes Clipper chip, has an electronic petition that can be signed by anybody on the Internet. And if you send them a message, the Internet address would be clipper.petition@cpsr.org. And somewhere in the text of the message, include the three words, I oppose Clipper.
In the text or in the subject?
In the text.
Okay.
The subject is ignored. In the text of the message, it has to say, I oppose Clipper. And they should return you a message acknowledging that you've been received, that, you know, that's been received. I think it's about the 50,000 signatures they've gotten so far.
Eli, when you were in prison, did you hear anything about the Clipper chip?
Hardly.
Yeah?
I hardly heard of anything.
Have you been updated as to the fact that the Clinton administration is pushing it?
Right,
through
I heard
vigor?
That.
Okay. It's definitely something that we'll be focusing on in the months ahead. All right, thanks for the information.
Okay, one more thing. I just want to mention that you had talked about switched credit cards. One of the most common ways your credit card is likely to get switched is extremely low-tech. If you're in a restaurant and you give it to the waiter or waitress and they take it away and they're passing it through the authorization terminal, you're very likely to get back somebody else's credit card. That's happened to me twice in my lifetime.
Really?
And I happened to catch it both times. I don't know why, because I very seldom look at the card when it comes back, but I did happen to catch it twice.
That's interesting. I guess there's all kinds of ways you could wind up with somebody's credit card.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, 212-279-3400. We have Acid Freak Eli here on the phone with us if you have any questions for him after the experience of 6 months in a federal pen. Please give us a call and share your thoughts. Good evening, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I think this Tonya Harding thing is like the pits.
Uh-huh.
Want my opinion. Is there anything that the people out here can do about this, you know?
In what sense? You mean to prevent people from being sent to prison or Tonya Harding?
Well, just to prevent, not to prevent, you know, people who, from going to prison, A, or to see that these people do go to prison, you know, like some of our friends out there, you know?
Well, let me ask Eli, what do you think? You think reporters like that should be sent to prison like hackers?
I think that if you're going to make an example of one, you have to make an example of everybody.
Okay, you don't sound like Eli, though. Eli, what do you think?
That is a difficult case, you know. In some ways, there might be a legitimate reason for it, but in other ways, there might not, you know?
Uh-huh. I don't know. I don't think two wrongs would make a right in this particular case. But by the same token, you know, these people have to learn that, you know, it's not right to condemn something and then just do it yourself.
Well, the other thing that it's not right to do, in my opinion, and you know, you can quote me on this, is that, you know, you shouldn't be going into other people's email because that's their private mail, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and whether or not it's encrypted or not, that's that's neither here nor there. Another point I wanted to bring up. There's a trade magazine out there called Communication News, the Applications Magazine for Networking and Information Management for February. There's an article in here about toll fraud, the multi-million-dollar telecom program, and it gets into these facts about how the telcos aren't the ones who are in the past 3 or 4 years. They're not the ones who toll fraud has been taking place on. It's been the PBXs and the other people who have call cell on their PBXs that have been the victims, so to speak. And it just tells you a little thing. there about how they got into it and how you can stop it and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Kind of interesting reading if you can get your hands on a copy.
And how do you get your hands on a copy?
Got me. My manager gets it in, gets it in, and I kind of like intercepted this copy. So I just on the cover it said hacking. I said, wow, you know.
Yeah.
And and see what these people have to say.
Well, the definition of hacking in a trade newsletter generally is very far from the definition of hackers in the hacker circle.
Absolutely. When people say, are you a hacker? I say, I don't know. I never made any furniture with an axe.
It's one thing, though, that I've noticed in a lot of these trade publications, when they talk about hackers, this is something new, too. They start talking about hackers and their customers. Like, they really make us into these criminal types that actually are selling things to people.
Selling anything.
It's incredible. And they want to believe this so badly because that makes it okay to lock us up and throw away the key because we're criminals and we're selling information. When hackers aren't interested in this kind of thing, they're interested in just learning about it and spreading information.
No,
nothing new there.
You're right. They're interested in like getting out the word and like, you know, if you know, it's crazy. It's totally absurd. The other thing, Charlie Rose last Tuesday had some stuff about the information dirt road. I mean, super high rate. and that was pretty interesting. They actually had a live demo on the internet and stuff. Anybody?
So they're catching up to the 80s, then, are they?
Yeah, they're catching up to the 80s.
That's good.
I kind of coined the term information dirt road after I heard it after a long time, because that's what it is.
Yeah, well, it's, I don't know, I have yet to think of some good analogies to that, but, I don't know, okay, here's one. Basically, all right, even though I hate the word frontier as far as electronic things go, basically, we have, as hackers, the thrill of plowing through the wilderness and kind of, seeing things for the first time, finding things, discovering things. Now, compare that to Jericho Turnpike, which is a very ugly road on Long Island, which has McDonald's every 5 feet and you know, all these strip malls and things like that. And that's what you have with the information superhighway. Yeah, the settlers come through there first and they find things, and everybody else follows in their campers and sports cars and everything like that. And bringing a lot of pollution, bringing a lot of traffic, bringing a lot of business, and there's your highway for you.
Bringing a lot of mediocrity, so to speak.
Yeah, you're toning it down, the network TV syndrome. You know, what do you say? Do you keep people from coming on to the Internet? No, of course not. But at the same time, the Internet has to remain interesting. You can't make it so that everybody isn't offended, you know, by it. It's got to be something that you get what you want out of it. You can't regulate it, you know?
Well, the thing that Mitch had mentioned on this thing on Charlie Rose last week was that that there are some virtual communities, so to speak, and I hate that term myself.
Yeah, me too.
Only because we've had bulletin boards for I don't know how many years, you know.
It just sounds so trendy, you know? Cyberspace, virtual world. I don't know. I just don't like it.
Talking asynchronously to each other for upwards of 10, 15 years now.
Right.
Now, you know, and now they come up with this thing. Well, there are virtual communities out there, okay? And some of these places where people go and hang out, you know, they do have their own sets of rules. And these people are going to be the people who make up the sets of rules for their own little niche wherever they are.
Yes.
That's the way that it should be, as far as I'm concerned. The people who are involved with the thing should make their rules in their own little Idaho, so to speak.
I mean, you really don't think that people that have absolutely no conception, no understanding, and no appreciation of these communities should be the ones making the rules? You really don't think so, huh?
No way.
Okay.
The guy from the administration was really funny on Charlie Rose's. He really couldn't describe what they wanted to do with it or that kind of stuff, and it was really kind of interesting to see where Stacy and Mitch had some stuff together, and this guy was just like, huh?
Uh-huh. Well, that's their job, I guess. Listen, thanks for the call.
Take it easy.
Okay. Eli, any comments on cyberspace?
I don't care much for those terms myself. I mean, I've heard them all, the highway, the cyberspace, the cracker. Heard it all, cyberpunk. That's all that media garbage.
Have any good crackers recently?
Crackers only in prison.
Yeah. You know, they call prison guards hacks, don't they?
Yeah, unfortunately they do.
But nobody seems to know why.
I don't understand it either.
Yeah. All right, let's go to another phone call. Good evening, you're on.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you were talking about credit cards tonight because I've got a problem and I hope you can help me with it here.
I can't raise your credit rating if that's what you want. But
No.
All right.
I have a Discover card, and the people at Discover gave me a call the other day telling me that they were asking why I was applying for another Discover card. I said I didn't know what they're talking about. So they put me through the Frauds Bureau, and some gentleman knew my name, my Social Security number, and my date of birth, but he used, his address, and he was trying to get a Discover card in my name. And I'm a college student, and the Frauds Bureau at Discover said that seven other leaving college students have also, he tried to do it with them. You know, he knows that they all go to Lehman. So I shouldn't have said the name of the college, but oh well.
Well, it's okay. I'm sure they like the publicity. But, it sounds like somebody just got a hold of a database that has that information. And, you know, in a school, of course, your Social Security number is everywhere. It's your name. It's how they post grades.
Well, the thing is, they're supposed to cover up the name. They just post the Social Security number and the grade. But this guy, it's like I said, in the name, date of birth, Social Security number, the whole bit. So, anyway, Discover said that I should call my local authorities and, you know, get in touch with my credit bureaus and the whole thing. So I called up, and they said there's nothing they can do unless you see on your credit report that there's been some discrepancy or something like that. So nothing can be done at this point. But I called the school, and they said the head of security gave me a call and left a message on the machine saying that he's checking it out. And, you know, the people at Discover, like I said, they gave me the address that they use, you know. So I'm wondering, you know, what can I do to protect, you know, anyone from messing with my credit or anything? And the fact that I heard that somebody knows your name, date of birth, and Social Security number, they can find out just about anything they want to about you. So I'm really concerned about this, you know.
Eli, any comments?
Well, I mean, I think you can narrow it down, like, who might have done it. I mean, they must have been really close to you personally or had access to your files because, when you fill out those applications, don't you have to, tell them where you work and how much you make and everything and your phone number and things like that?
I think it's a leak in the administration at my college.
They actually give you a copy of that application?
You mean the credit card application?
Yeah.
I had this card for like 3-4 years, and it's so long ago, I don't remember.
No, did they give you a copy of the new application?
I don't think they did. They just, I think they just mailed the card to me, you know. It was like stuck to this piece of cardboard with a little bit of information on there, like intro.
No, I mean the second app, the fake one, did they send you a copy of that?
No, this guy, you can apply over the phone for a Discover card.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's what he did. And it's like I said, it was 6 or 7 other Lehman College students, you know. He knows that, you know, we all go to Lehman College, you know.
Well, let me ask you a question. Did he use the same address for each one of these people?
According to the Frauds Bureau, yep.
Well, then they know who he is.
Yeah, I thought the police would be interested in that because the fact that, you know, I know the address and everything, but they said they can't do anything unless, he actually has the card and he used it or something like that. They said there's nothing they could do at this point, you know.
So I guess this is a crime that they can overlook, huh?
It seems that way. I mean, this is a clear case of somebody obviously intending to use your name, your Social Security number, your date of birth, and do something with that under your name.
Right.
And they're not interested in following that up, at least even talking to the person saying, stop doing this. You know, maybe that would be enough to stop them.
That's what I'm thinking of doing, you know.
But they're not going to do that. I mean, that's unbelievable, and they would send people to prison for much less things.
Well, it's not juicy enough, that's what it is, you know.
Yeah, I guess the media can't get its teeth into it.
Yeah, that's what they need.
I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you have our sympathies. I mean, did they give you the address?
Yeah, I have it, yep.
Well, send the guy a letter, anonymously, of course.
Yeah.
Say you're on to shenanigans there, and then you better stop it, or it's going to be some problems.
Right. I was also thinking of, you know, contacting the college paper and letting them know.
Well, what state is he in?
In the Bronx, right here in New York.
He's in the Bronx. Go to a library, find a library, see if anybody has the Kohl's directory. Kohl's directory is a reverse phone book.
C-O-L-E-S?
C-O-L-E-S. Uh-huh. Look up the address in the Kohl's directory, you'll see the name.
Uh-huh.
And you also see the phone number. And then you know who he is.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I guess I'll have to
go, you know, do this on my own because nobody else is. I called the Bureau of Public Affairs, you know, Department of Public Affairs, and they couldn't help. Consumer Affairs couldn't help.
I know. I know exactly what you're going through.
Federal Trade Commission, nobody can
try,
help.
Try complaining about a co-cut or about something unfair with the phone company. You go through the same thing. I know. It's terrible. We need some you know, regulation in the right places and some people that understand technology.
Right.
Keep us updated, though, okay?
Okay, I will. Thanks.
All right. Good luck. That's just all too typical, isn't it?
Yeah.
Too many things like that going on. I think we have time for another phone call. Good evening. Who's there?
Hi, Goldstein. Yeah, I haven't seen any of you people at 53rd Street in about 2 years. Been in a little trouble with the FBI myself. I got zinged on my Social Security card, too. No reference to the above-mentioned thing.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to call about an earlier show that's been bouncing around in BAI on the midday shift. It's Marguerite Moore. She's talking about some black guy in New York.
Well, what does that have to do with this?
Well, this guy's got the ultimate thing, you know, the crime of somebody put something that is supposedly, in quotes, electrical device or electronics device, either telemetry or position or some kind of respondent
uh-huh.
in his body.
Okay.
Big thing at BAI on the morning shift. Everybody's kind of like, they've seen the guy, and they're very hurt by what they see. So if it's a fraud, it's a real good one. It's an ace.
Well, I'll have to get up in the morning to find out about that.
It's real fantastic. It's in our area, within 100 miles of this area. It's happened since 89.
I see.
Fairly strange stuff. I mean, you know, really crazy.
Yeah. Well, thanks for updating us.
If anybody on AMs, they'll know about it.
Okay, I will.
Bye-bye.
Take care. You know what? I think I'm going to take one more call. Good evening. You're on.
Yeah.
What's up?
Hi, I had a question about the bracelet that Eli's wearing. Not that he'd want to do this, but could he, if he wanted to, bypass it by picking up his phone and leaving it off the hook and then walking out the door? And would that prevent it from dialing up his parole officer?
Good question.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
we're not suggesting you do that, obviously.
Oh, obviously I'm not going to do that.
Theoretically.
But I'm wondering, would it work? Theoretically, I don't know if that would work.
Well, are you not required to have your phone line open or something?
Yeah, I have a special line put in that I have to pay for myself.
Oh, you had to have a special phone line, too?
Yeah, because I can't have call waiting, and my other line has call waiting on it.
Why can't you have call waiting?
Because they want to be able to get through any time they want. They want that hotline.
Uh-huh.
And what it does is even if I try to make a phone call on that phone, it'll only last 15 minutes, and then...
just like in prison.
Right, and the device will just... We'll just cut you off, and then you can pick up again and dial again. I mean, they just do that. So if there's a phone call to be made, it'll make it, you know.
I see. Hmm. Wow, so I guess if you were to do that, it would, something would trigger something. If you have that phone off the hook, that's probably a violation in itself, right?
Yeah, I suppose it is. I mean, that would be tampering with the monitoring device or something. I don't know.
Did they ever explain to you what the point of having you stay at home for 6 months is?
I mean,
what are you staying away from?
I'm staying away from all the bad things that are out there that may influence me.
Well,
I assume you're allowed to go out at certain times to get food and such, right?
And
the hacker in the plastic bubble.
I think you can only order Domino's, something like that. Are you allowed to go out and get food or what?
No, I can't even do that.
Well, how do you eat?
Yeah, how do you eat?
They have to bring it to me. Somebody has to do me favors. You know, it's not only a sentence for me, it's for everybody around me.
What if you're at work and you're on your way home from work? Can you stop in the grocery store and pick something up?
Well, see, the way it works is you give them a schedule, you have to follow that schedule. You have to let them know what time you'll be back by, and they analyze your schedule and see if it's legitimate. And you can stop by on the way, but you got to be home by that time. Otherwise, you know, the phone will go off and call them and let them know I'm late.
Well, welcome to 1984. Hey, thanks for the call. And that's going to pretty much do it for us as far as time goes. Eli, you have my sympathies, really. I'm glad you're out. I'm really glad to hear your voice again. You know, we were playing telephone tag for, one-sided tag because I couldn't call you, but for 6 months you were trying to reach me and I just wasn't around. And then yesterday, for the first time in quite some time, I heard your voice again and it was really good to hear you.
Yeah, listen, when you drop by, bring me a pizza.
Hey, I'll do that. I will. And I intend to drop by quite a bit, and I hope all your friends out there that are listening also visit. And well, it's just good to have you back in what's left of the free world out here.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be in touch over the next couple of months or whatever, and we'll keep people updated as to what's going on with you.
Okay.
Thanks again for speaking with us tonight. And this is Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Hook. We'll be back again next week with more news from the world of technology. Stay tuned for the evening news. This is WBAI, New York. Good evening. In the news tonight, Congress's crime bill, a rational response or a knee-jerk reaction to the problem. What if three strikes you're out also applied to white-collar crime? A critical look at immigration Florida style. And in New York, the poor and the homeless continue to take it on the chin in the battles of the budgets. With these and other stories, I'm David Sears in New York with Verna Avery Brown in Washington, and this is the news for Wednesday, March 16, 1994. First to Washington for these stories topping the news.
President Clinton met today with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin on the second day of his visit to Washington. Both leaders said they were determined to put the peace process back on track.
I call on Chairman Arafat of the PLO to resume talks immediately and act like me, to fight terror as if there were no negotiations, and conduct the negotiation if there was not terror.
Despite the three-week interruption in the peace talks, Rabin said negotiations with the PLO were near the finishing line. But neither Rabin nor Clinton announced any specific concessions to bring the PLO back to the negotiating table following last month's Hebron massacre. In Israel, the PLO news agency reported today that Yasser Arafat has sent a letter to President Clinton asking him to salvage the peace process. And in the occupied territories, the situation between Palestinians and Israelis is still tense. Daoud Kutab reports from Jerusalem.
Islamic clergymen who were invited to testify at the Israeli commission investigating the Hebron killings refused to go today, saying that they would only cooperate with an international inquiry. Although West Bank and Gaza schools were opened, the situation in the occupied territories has not calmed down. More than 20 days since the Hebron massacre, tensions between Israelis and Palestinians frustrate attempts at an early return to the peace talks. The anger of Palestinians is not restricted to the killings in Hebron, but to the attitude of the Israeli army ever since. 60 people were injured today as a result of Israeli soldiers' tough reactions to Palestinian demonstrators. For Pacifica Network News, this is Daoud Kutab reporting from East Jerusalem.
Supreme Court Justice David Souter today rejected an emergency request from a Boston veterans group to ban homosexuals from Sunday's St. Patrick's Day parade. The Irish veterans group has said it would cancel this year's parade if the homosexuals were not barred. In Haiti today, right-wing groups announced that they would form a new provisional government. Roosevelt Jean-Francois reports from Port-au-Prince.
A spokesman for the coalition of Haitian politicians who opposed the return of President Aristide to Haiti said today that a new government should take office pretty soon. No specific date was given. Officials of the Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti said that this provisional government will include all forces which have fought against the reinstatement of President Aristide. They also affirmed that they have the support of the army. They called to the population to make pressure on the parliament to vote a resolution for a new de facto government. Roosevelt, Jean-François, Pacifica Network News, Port-au-Prince.
last night, Democratic Congressman Dan Rostenkowski surprised even himself by winning the Illinois primary election with a resounding 50%. The chair of the House Ways and Means Committee beat four challengers despite unresolved questions about his campaign and congressional finances. In Bosnia today, Serb troops again refused to allow a convoy of relief supplies to enter the besieged Muslim town of Maglaj. The UN High Commission for Refugees has applied every day for the last week to enter the town. Maglaj has not had a relief supply since last October. A UN official said the Bosnian Serbs were trying to push the UN resolve to the last raw nerve. International nuclear inspectors say North Korea would not let them see a nuclear processing plant. The partial failure of the mission means that the U.S. may postpone talks with North Korea, scheduled for Monday. And those are the stories topping the news. The crime bill on Capitol Hill is being touted as a reasonable approach to a growing crisis. Even liberal congressional members are calling it a shift of the legislative winds. But is it a balanced approach? Pacifica's Don Rush has this look at the issue as the measure struggled its way through the House Judiciary Committee today.
Crime is now the number one issue in the public opinion polls, and this morning, Committee Chair Jack Brooks set the scene for congressional efforts to fight it.
Our streets are stained with blood. Our homes are bolted shut. And no matter how hard anyone tries, there is no escape from the reality that we cannot be truly free as a nation when we live in terror.
The nation is now emerging from the law and order era of President Ronald Reagan, when the government prided itself on being tough on crime. But liberals like New York Democrat Charles Schumer are hailing a change in the thinking of his colleagues. He declared the legislation is
what I think is a very fine and balanced package that tries to be smart on both the punishment and prevention sides.
But the package making its way through Congress is filled with tougher punishment. It includes a three-time loser bill that would send a criminal defendant to life in prison. It allows juveniles to be tried as adults for certain serious crimes. And it creates over 50 new capital punishment offenses. This morning, the committee tried to balance this out with a measure that would ease punishment on first-time nonviolent offenders. The committee even allowed for such an offender to have at least one minor offense, like reckless driving. Specifically, this law is aimed at those who may have gotten caught up in low-level drug trafficking operations. It is not clear how many federal prisoners would be affected, but for New Mexico Republican Stephen Schiff, even this was too much.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that we are creating a recruiting poster for the major drug dealers in terms of whom to target to bring into their organization. These mules, as they're called, are absolutely essential to the major drug traffickers, and we're sure helping them recruit more.
Another classic example was the battle over crack and powder cocaine. The punishment is 100 times higher for crack than it is for powder cocaine, and it is used mostly in the inner city. An amendment was offered up to lower the punishment for crack towards the level of powder cocaine, and Michigan Democrat John Conyers, a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, urged his colleagues to support the measure.
In 92, the last time that figures were available, 92.6% of all defendants sentenced for federal crack cocaine offenses were African American. All of the defendants sentenced for possession of crack cocaine were African American. Please, on the basis of these uncontroverted racial disparities, I urge the support of this amendment.
But conservatives like Schiff were not happy with that idea. Instead, he pushed the author of the amendment, William Hughes of New Jersey, in another direction.
The gentleman is proposing to reduce the penalties for crack cocaine.
Yeah.
I wonder if the gentleman would support raising the penalties for powdered cocaine.
Well, I'm not so sure that the penalties for powdered cocaine is inadequate.
Hughes finally gave up against such conservative opposition, but promised to be back with new language. Eventually, the committee will get around to the prevention side of the equation. The House is expected to match the $22 billion approved by the Senate. Ruth Flowers with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She notes much of that money goes for law enforcement, not rehabilitation.
This is in a context where most of the preventive programs were decimated during the 1980s with all the other discretionary domestic program cutbacks. So we've been through a little more than a decade now where the programs that can do the most to stop crime have not had a chance to operate.
Still, members of the Congressional Black Caucus see the new emphasis on crime prevention as a change of the political winds. Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
As Congress puts together a new, meaner crime bill, our representatives on Capitol Hill try to outdo each other who can be the toughest on crime. The crime bills currently being considered contain a three-time loser provision. While Congress focuses on street crime, they're ignoring the white-collar criminal. Pacifica's Mark Beavis takes a look at what would happen if three strikes and you're out put away corporate criminals.
After three convictions, the violent criminal would be put in prison for good. That's the premise of the three strikes and you're out provisions of the crime bills making their way through Congress. But is a violent criminal only the person who robs you on the street with a deadly weapon? Or is it the corporation that dumps toxic chemicals into your water system? Mark Maurer with the Sentencing Project points out that with all the talk about crime, no one is talking about white-collar offenders.
In all the crime hysteria of the last several months, I haven't heard any discussion about the wave of savings and loan frauds or whether or not we've had an increase in white-collar crime in recent years. Instead, all that discussion has been about the so-called street crime, which is very serious, but white-collar crime is also a serious problem, and there's been virtually no discussion at all about how much white-collar crime there is and what should be appropriate responses to it.
And Maurer's got some numbers. An FBI report from 1989 cites 3 million burglaries costing about $3 billion, but the savings and loan scandals have cost taxpayers an estimated $300 to $500 billion, 100 times more.
So white-collar crime has been enormously expensive. Some people suggest sometimes that we don't take it as seriously street crime because it's nonviolent crime. I think it can be violent in its own way. We can think of crimes like environmental pollution, which may not kill us directly, but certainly indirectly has some very serious health consequences to people. It's just not the same as getting mugged in an alley. You don't necessarily see the offender, but the result can be just the same.
Bernard Grimm is a criminal defense attorney. He calls the concept of three strikes and you're out for white-collar criminals innovative, but on the practical level, unnecessary.
In my experience, white-collar defendants don't come through the system a third time. So it's usually the stigma, humiliation, embarrassment, cost and expense, and usual job loss that accompanies an indictment against a white-collar defendant is the end of the road for him.
Representative Barney Frank, Democrat from Massachusetts, argues focusing on white-collar criminals is missing the point.
I think we ought to be tough on white-collar crime, but I don't know very many people who say, oh, I am afraid to go out of the house today. I might be victimized by insider trading. We don't have poor people living in housing projects who are worried that they may be the victim of securities fraud. The fact is that violent crime, particularly, frankly, impacts on the lives of poor people. There are people who live in housing projects, the poorest of the poor in this society, who live lives that no human being ought to have to live.
Others say the laws against white-collar crime are on the books. All it takes is a concerted effort to enforce them. Russell Mochiber has an idea. Mochiber is the editor of the Washington-based Corporate Crime Reporter. He suggests the federal government pass a three-times-in-your-out law for those companies convicted of defrauding the government. Three times, and the company can no longer work on a government contract.
You can't put a corporation in jail, but the effective sanction against a corporation that does most of its business with government, that at getting taxpayer money, is to prohibit that corporation from doing business with the government. It's called debarment. It's rarely used against major corporations, but it's an effective sanction, and it should be used. So three strikes, you're out should be applied to those corporations that defraud the government, and these 20 major corporations, many of them have defrauded the government more than three times. Honeywell, Hughes Aircraft, Linton Industries, General Electric 16 times, Boeing Corporation 4 times, Raytheon 4 times. So you just go right down the list, and these companies would be prohibited from doing business with the government.
McIver admits the idea has little or no chance in Congress. Not only do those companies have a great deal of power on Capitol Hill, if they were all kept from government contracts, there'd be no more defense industry. Mark Beavis, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
Congress is considering immigration asylum reform, an issue that arouses particularly strong feelings in border states. The government estimates that 300,000 illegal immigrants enter the U.S. each year. While some immigrant groups complain that the law discriminates against them, some other citizens object that immigration policy is not restrictive enough. Reporter Alan Litke is in Florida, where he files this first in a three-part series on that state's immigration policies.
Retired Immigration and Naturalization Service officer John Adamczak is grateful for Lady Liberty's promise of an open door to the tired and poor refugees of the old world.
Many of them, like myself, are children of aliens who came into the United States legally, waited their turns to come into the United States legally. After coming into the country, worked very, very hard to learn the language and become United States citizens. Most of the aliens coming into the United States today will openly tell you they don't want to be citizens. They're here only until they're ready to retire and then move back to their own countries.
So, Adamczak spoke at recent hearings in Fort Lauderdale of the House Republican Research Committee's Task Force on Illegal Immigration. Florida has this country's third largest population of undocumented immigrants. They pay more than $300 million in state and local taxes, but this week, Governor Lawton Chiles announced plans to sue the federal government for some of the nearly $1 billion the state spends on social services for them. Representative Clay Shaw of Fort Lauderdale backs a Republican bill to streamline deportation proceedings for undocumented immigrants.
When these people are caught on the beach, what does INS say? They say, let them go. They have no place to put them. You never see them again. They never show up for hearings, and they disappear into the community. They show up at our hospitals and have their babies. The babies then go into our schools, and they also have a tremendous disproportionate impact on our prison systems because of the violation of our laws.
The Republicans want to...